Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
Well, good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Yes, it's Saturday afternoon, the time of the week when I bring Christians and non-Christians together here on the show that aims to get you thinking. And don't forget, you can find us online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can download the podcast there. You can find past shows, features, resources, and all sorts of other things. Do check it out online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. We'll also be giving out the ways to get in touch with the programme a little bit later on, and we'll be hearing some of your thoughts on the past few weeks of programming towards the end of today's show. Don't forget that after Unbelievable at 4 o'clock, there's the profile interview. You'll want to stick around for that. Exciting guest today joins Premier's political editor, Martin Eden. It's going to be Jim Wallace, who's a social action campaigner in the States. He's well known out there, the head of Sojourners. So listen out for that after Unbelievable this afternoon. But right now, let's get into the show today and find out who's joining me on the programme.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the show, we're talking about evidence, atheism and the case for God. And today it's a discussion between my guests, church leader Rice Brooks and musician David Beebe. And we're going to be finding out all about them. Let me tell you, though, that Rice is a co-founder of the Every Nation family of churches and author of a recently published book, God's Not Dead. We're going to be finding out about that, what he's doing over here in the UK. He has a guest with him as well, who we'll be meeting as well in the course of today's programme. David is a musician, an atheist, a show listener. So it's good to have some input from people who have found the show and have decided to accept my invitation to come in and have a chat. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining me today. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, first of all, Rice. You've literally just flown in. You've been in Dublin recently, but you're a resident in the States, aren't you?
Yes, thank you, Justin, and thank you, David, and have Brian Miller here with me.
We'll meet Brian in a moment,
actually.
Yes,
we flew in 2 days ago, and then I went to Dublin with Brian yesterday, and we spoke at Trinity College and UCD and had a meeting last night and then got on an early morning flight back here, so we're here.
Yeah, well, you're doing very well. The jet lag is yet to kick in, maybe, I don't know.
The tea is helping.
Okay, good. Tell us a little bit about God's Not Dead, because this is a book, but it's more than that, I think. It's a song. It's going to be a film. Tell us a little bit about the God's Not Dead.
Well, basically, this is just a book that lays out an overview of the evidence for God. Many times people say there is no evidence. It's just something that is blind faith. And so one of the chapters is called Real Faith Isn't Blind. Basically saying that faith certainly requires what we would think traditionally is faith, but yet it is not a blind step. It's faith based on evidence. So what I tried to do is to lay out what that evidence is so that when people say you have no proof, then, well, here's the proof that we offer. Here's the evidence that we offer. So, yes, there was a song, a Christian band, Newsboys had a song, have a song, God's Not Dead, and then there will be a movie coming out that it's not based on the book, but, you know, I gave some input in terms of maybe some of the descriptions and what do you say if somebody says, what is the evidence for God? So
the Newsboys, I mean, they're popular here on Premier Christian Radio. We play quite a few of their songs. Are they connected to the church that you founded?
Some of the members have attended. They travel a lot, but they've many of them have been friends. I was friends very close with Peter Furler, who used the former lead singer.
Yeah.
And so, but anyway, there's Nashville is a pretty closed community, so we all know each other. So we're.
And that's where things started out for you. Now there are churches, Every Nation churches all over the world, aren't there?
And we primarily work on college campuses, so we're on about 700 college campuses, and start there in engaging students, and out of that communities spring up, and hopefully those students grow older, and they do grow older, and the communities form, and then but it does reach out to the entire community. So it's not just campus-based, but it's a very strong campus component.
And that's what you're over here doing in the coming week. You're going to be speaking, I've got the details in front of me, at Imperial College, Queen Mary University. You're in Slough, Stratford, Hammersmith, Tuesday through to Thursday, I think, Tuesday to Thursday the 10th. And you're going to be sort of doing talks about the evidence for God?
Yes, I have Dr. Brian Miller here, who's a physicist from Duke and MIT. So we kind of tag team and give a presentation of the evidence for God. And so we go back and forth talking, going from just what does science say, going into the history, going into the philosophy, and then the personal experience.
Great.
Of the experience of God in individual lives.
Well, if you want to find out more about the dates that Rice is speaking at on some campuses and other places in the coming week, then do check out godsnotdead.co.uk. That's where you can find out more details about his speaking dates here in the UK while he's over. You've mentioned Brian already, so let's bring you into the conversation quickly, Brian. Thank you very much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I've always been a fan of the show.
Well, it's always lovely to meet someone who you don't have to explain what the show is, because they've already been listening somewhere around the world. So I really appreciate the fact that you've come over. You're a physicist by background.
Yeah, I have Rice has said, I have a PhD in physics from Duke University, and what I've done is after finishing my PhD, I've done a lot of work in the relationship of faith and science and culture, and I've also done consulting with churches along those lines.
Great. Okay. So you're here to sort of give some sort of scientific sort of aspect to the talks. For you, was that an important part of your own conversion?
What happened was when I went to college, I was raised in the church, but for me, it wasn't very significant until I had learned more about the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I read through the New Testament, I had a pretty dramatic encounter with God, and that's what really brought me fully to faith.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went to college, I studied the Bible from a skeptical perspective, had a professor who was an atheist, and then also read Richard Dawkins' The Blind Watchmaker. So for a while, I became pretty convinced that Christianity was just a psychological crutch.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was I felt that many Christians didn't really think about their faith. And that put me on a journey.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a journey that was both intellectual and spiritual. So I had studied theology and archaeology and science, cosmology, biology. And then over time, I realized that a lot of the arguments that convinced me that Christianity wasn't true, I realized were not as strong as I originally thought.
Mm-hmm.
And that the science, as many people say, a little science takes you away from God, but a lot of science brings you back.
Okay. That's an interesting way of putting it. Yeah. Thank you for joining anyway, and we might bring you into the conversation a bit later on. But let's turn our attention to our other guest. Do you prefer Dave or David?
I introduced myself as David. I think I prefer David.
Okay, yeah, David is fine. David Beebe, welcome along to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you, because I think we'd hoped to bring you on a few weeks ago when we had J. Warner Wallace on, but it didn't work out for various reasons. You've recently got married, so congratulations.
Yes,
that
was the reason why I couldn't make it.
Exactly. It just happened your flight was delayed or something.
Yeah,
but tell us a little bit about yourself, David. You've been listening to the show for a while. How did you discover Unbelievable, if you don't mind me asking?
Sure, yeah. I actually stumbled across it via Mark Driscoll, because I listened to Mars Hill podcasts on a weekly basis.
Now, this may be striking you already as a bit strange, because we've already said you're an atheist.
Yeah.
You're listening to sermons on your podcast. What's that all about?
Yeah, I try to. I mean, yes, I'm an atheist. I wasn't brought up that way. Religion, God was just a bit of a non-issue in the house, and I think perhaps the wider area as well in the town which I live with. It wasn't until I went away to university where I discovered that there were the people in the world that really, really did believe. And I guess I sort of careered through my early 20s just focused on music and not really thinking much beyond that. But as I got to my mid to late 20s, I started to think more about the wider questions in life and started reading a lot and listening. And I guess that I've been more swayed towards the atheist side. But I always try to engage with you know, religious believers, and try to really immerse myself and understand where they're coming from.
Yeah. You weren't raised with any kind of religious aspect to your upbringing. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably coming a little bit. I understand one of your relatives is an evangelical Christian, and so you've sort of had
my brother-in-law actually. We're good friends, and we have many healthy discussions on it. And I listen to his church's podcasts, sermons every week as well, at King's Arms in Bedford. I kind of like to think of myself as the honorary atheist member of that, because I've listened to every one for the last 4 years. So,
that's amazing.
That's more than many church members would have listened to.
But, and he's fascinating because, you know, he's a lovely guy, and we get on really well, and we have great, healthy discussion, and that's part of why I find this show so interesting. And the job that you do, Justin, as I was saying earlier on, it's really good. I think you don't hide that you're a Christian, but you know, you do, I think, a decent job of trying to go down the middle. Be fair.
Well, hopefully. Thank you. That's a great compliment, and I appreciate that a lot. We're going to be talking today, David, about evidence, and that's essentially what Rice presents in the book. You've had a chance to read it, or at least you've listened to the audiobook, certainly. When it comes to apologetics, defence of the Christian faith, evidence and so on, have your eyes been open to anything in the course of doing that? Do you feel like you a little more persuaded than you were, or has it really just sort of confirmed your atheism as you've read evidence for the existence of God and so on?
I just have to just a quick preface in that it's very humbling sitting in these chairs because, you know, the minds that have sat in, you know, in the studio before is I have to say that I'm ultimately as lay as they come. I'm the ultimate layman.
That's
so,
all right.
I want to say thanks for, you know, giving me the chance to actually speak. So, but you can, both anyone can feel free to krause me and buzz in if I'm talking nonsense, especially with the physicists in there. But but to answer your question, sorry. I think that mostly, I wouldn't say it's confirmed it, but I know it's very difficult to be a blank slate. I know, I'm sure I was. I wasn't, and I've got my biases. But I haven't really came across any sort of argument for specifically Christianity. I think I've heard fairly convincing, perhaps deistic arguments. I think you can make a convincing case there. But for strong theism, I haven't, convinced.
We'll get into some of the meat of the book pretty soon. Rice, just take us through God's Not Dead. You basically kind of, as far as I can see, sort of outline about nine kind of areas
that you
deal with a heck of a lot of stuff as well. It covers a wide range of material. Was it just really just to kind of put out there in a kind of fairly popular format a lot of the stuff that's out there that kind of can get quite technical, but sort of boiled down a bit first?
Sure, yeah. It's, giving an overview to the average person. I have five children, so one of the targets is my 14 and 16-year-old, to basically say, when people say, what is your proof or evidence for God? And I don't say proof in a mathematical sense, but just I have a brother that's an attorney, so we say beyond a reasonable doubt, is this something that we can say is true or false? And every one of us have to make those kind of conclusions every day about claims, whether it's the, you know, the $15 Rolex watch on the street that somebody says is real, and you go, really? So there's all kinds of things that we're all skeptics about. I'm a skeptic about things, and so we have to use that to test the truth of claims. And so, but as you begin to listen to what has been called the new atheist and this new strand of atheism, I wouldn't say new; it's now gotten a little bit, almost a decade under its belt. But you begin to hear certain things repeat itself, like faith is blind, that there's no, that we are irrational, that somehow that we've been lobotomized and our faith is wishful thinking. It's the, you know, synonymous with the tooth fairy or the flying spaghetti monster or fictitious characters that, well, we can't not prove that. So in the same way, we cannot not prove God. So it kind of sets this thing up to where the average believer who doesn't have any clue to any sort of evidence just kind of discards their faith like an out-of-date cell phone, you know, just, hey, I'm done with this. And so in terms of laying out the book, one of the chapters starts out, you know, giving kind of an overview of the whole history of from Nietzsche saying God is dead and what that was all about, and Time magazine asking, is God dead? Mm-hmm. and then walking through to, you know, then all of a sudden there's some second thoughts about that. You know, is God making a comeback? You know, Time Magazine has kind of a another thing about that. Mm-hmm. So one of the primary chapters is that starts out as real faith isn't blind. Mm-hmm. So, and I think the kind of the backdrop of that is that, you know, and I'm kind of a little analogy, you know, when I was teaching my children to swim or jump in the pool, you know, I would stand in the, or I would be in the water and the child would be on the bank of the pool and I'd be saying, jump. And I mean, the little 5-year old was, you know, the evidence, you know, that's my dad. He takes me to McDonald's. He, you know, protects me from the monster under the bed. And they would jump to me based on the evidence of, they had enough evidence to trust the step I was asking them to take, or the leap, if you will. Mm. So I believe that as we look at the evidence for God, not only in nature, if we look at through reason itself, and then ultimately in history, I think that there's a, I think the arguments for God's existence are better than the arguments against his existence.
And so in the book, you go through, as you say, real faith isn't blind. You talk about the moral argument, essentially, good and evil are no illusions. There was a beginning, so a sort of cosmological argument. Life is no accident, fine-tuning and the nature of DNA and so on. Meaning and purpose, Jesus and the resurrection, the witness of Scripture. And then the grace effect, the sort of the impact of Christianity in culture and society and so on, and sort of finish off with some stories of people who have come
it's
to faith.
Living proof.
Some way, living proof.
Yeah, the grace effect is a friend of mine named Larry Taunton. You ought to have Larry. Larry's a
fantastic
guy.
I know Larry, yeah.
And, yeah, Larry he became friends with Christopher Hitchens, and they took a car trip before Chris's death, Hitchens' death. And that's a book he wrote, Grace Effect, so I gave him credit.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to name a chapter after you, or after your book.
So as I say, I mean, that's a lot of kind of lines of evidence that you're bringing to the table. I mean, coming back to you, David, having had a chance to read the book and so on, you're probably familiar with all of those lines of evidence to some degree, more or less. Is there any way you want to start in terms of this? I mean, when it comes to the kind of evidence that it would take to convince you, are these the kinds of things that are pertinent to that, as it were, would you say?
That's a really difficult question. I think it's been asked of many greater atheist minds than mine, but I don't really know what would convince me. But the arguments or the evidence is in your book, I don't find persuasive. So I think it's... So it does make it very difficult.
I suppose it would be good to kind of establish to me what is the kind of
there are different
thing that you would be looking for. You know, are you kind of look if for God to exist, would you expect to find sort of some kind of
if it was glaringly
revelation,
obvious,
some glaringly obvious thing
that was very very. It always looks a little bit too much like it's. It's like reasoning after the fact. So like, or without being facetious or asking silly questions, like why reveal through script like books or through writing? I mean, if something was that important, so crucially important to the eternal fate of my soul, then I think I would be wanting something more solidly objective and like so you could not
mistake it.
Maybe that.
I mean, okay, what do you make of this then Bryce? Is that
First of all, I think that let's just the evidence for God, I would start if David and I were sitting here, if we weren't on microphone and we had just met and had a cup of tea and David said, look, I listened to your book or read your book, and I'm not convinced of that. And I would basically start with, you know, does God exist? Because faith begins with the existence of God. It says he who comes to God must believe that God exists. So if you don't believe there's a God, then you certainly don't believe he could write a book or inspire others to write a book. So trying to prove the Bible, if you don't even accept the existence of God, is a little maybe cart before the horse. So, I think the Scripture itself speaks of that. It says that God's nature and attributes are clearly seen. through what's been made. So, for instance, when we talk about, let's just take, instead of going through all nine chapters, let me just kind of group it into three. Let's take, and maybe this could be a good discussion kind of category, meaning and morality. So if there is a God, or let's just put it this way, if there is no God, is there really such a thing as ultimate meaning or purpose? Maybe this is a question, David, because I know you're a, I mean, I've seen some of the things, you know, you're a healthy guy, you work out, you know, we have something in common. We both like Superman.
Indeed,
so
common ground.
I'm the old school Superman, black and white, you know, he's the, no, but I do share that, the Superman affinity there. But in thinking about that saying, so here's the evidence, or let's talk about meaning. Is there really such a thing as purpose?
Mm.
So I would submit that a pointless beginning would mean a pointless existence. So if there is no reason that we came into existence, then how can we'd have to just pretend that there is a reason now, or there is a point to our existence. Then we can make up one. Or like the philosophers would say, yes, life is meaningless, but you look into that meaninglessness and kind of, I guess Nietzsche would say, you kind of just project your own meaning. And that's the Superman, really, is the one who projects his own meaning into the abyss. And so I would start with these two topics of, is there really such a thing as meaning and purpose, ultimate? And then we can talk about, is there really an ultimate objective moral value? Are morals
do you take that first point that without a God, that we live in a kind of meaningless universe in that sense, David? I don't know how you...
Well, ultimately, I don't know. I'm not claiming to know. I would guess that at bottom it does look that way to me, as if there is no purpose, ultimate purpose. But I don't know. I think it's very... To claim, I think, against the evidence, more specifically in the moment, I hope, but... you know, I'm not making the claim that there is.
I mean, when Rice says there, the best an atheist can do if they don't believe in God is to project their own meaning into the universe. Is that what you would call meaning in life? Is kind of what you make of life? Is what you sort of project onto this blank slate that we've been given, as it were?
You know, I operate as if there is meaning, but I mean, you have to pull yourself up from your bootstraps somehow. Otherwise, you know, there has to be. Otherwise, there is no point, I suppose, in getting out of bed in the morning at all. And I can see where, you know, the argument is coming from, but it doesn't. It doesn't really. I don't think that is evidence, because you can't say that there is. I don't feel like you can definitively say that there is.
I would obviously beg to differ on that, because I think that really we can't really exist without it. I think if you look at living organisms, there's purpose. I think you then go into some of the what you call scientific evidence, where you see the very beginning of the universe, at the Big Bang, the fine-tuning argument. And if somebody's listening, and I think this is important too, Justin, because a lot of skeptics dismiss the arguments for God, or the evidence for God, as if everybody understands it. I mean, it's like I've listened to people like, whether it's A.C. Grayling or Dawkins, and they just kind of whisk past fine tuning. It would be like walking through a herd, you know, 800-pound gorillas and acting like, hey, there was nothing unusual there. I mean, we're talking about from the very beginning of the universe. Looking at your knobs in this station, it would be like if we had a universe starter kit. You have this incredible fine tuning from the very beginning of, like, if you've got gravity, how much, and I've seen you in here twisting the knobs, how much gravity do you put in a universe?
Yeah, yeah.
If you turn the knob too much, then, you know, it doesn't get out of the blocks. If you don't have, or if you turn it too little, you know, you molecules won't form, stars won't form. So from the very beginning of the universe, I would say that is a compelling argument that intelligence, this is, you know, before the earth was formed, before evolution would have happened or any of those things, the universe began. And I think that beginning is compelling.
I mean, these are familiar arguments to you, I'm sure, yeah. David, the fine tuning of the universe, the universe had a beginning. And obviously Rice, for him, the best explanation is that there is a design, a purpose to the universe. Mm-hmm. Is on your opinion, Rice valid? You know, is it okay for him to take that point of view, or do you think he's missing something? Is there a better explanation, as far as you're concerned, for those kinds of issues, or is it just a case of, well, we just don't know?
I think that the proofs and the evidences that you give, it's not so much those. I mean, I've heard many of them, like before, like the Lee Strobel books. It seems like he used some of those kind of arguments, like those three books that he wrote.
In the Resurrection later in the book. Yeah, I talk about him.
But it's not so much those. I think it's the way in which you assess the evidence, I think, is, I don't mean to sound disrespectful, but it seems to be faulty reasoning in assessing it. So as a skeptic, as I go through it, it's like you're starting with the conclusion that God exists, and then the evidence...
The book is pretty bold. I mean, this is a it's a pretty big title.
God's
But then all the evidence is seen in light of that, rather than the other way around. So, for example, what I wanted to perhaps get into, and I may regret this now with Brian sitting in the room, is chapter 4 and 5. The juxtaposition of those two chapters was fascinating.
Just to remind you, that's the chapter 4, there was a beginning, and chapter 5, life is no accident. Okay, go on.
So now, I get the feeling, I've listened to your voice for over a week now on rotation and all the arguments, and so it's quite interesting when seeing you sitting there and speaking, saying different words. So I get the feeling that we're both not experts in any of these fields. Is that, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong.
That's why I travel with the physicists. But when you make a claim, in other words, when I make a claim, let's say if I make just a basic mathematical claim, you know, 2 times 2 is 4, that's a truth. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't matter what level of education in that. I have a doctoral degree, but it's in, you know, intercultural studies and missiology. So I look like a Democrat from Mississippi, the DMIS. But when I go and we go onto campuses and you make claims like I do in the book, then I believe they're not just me making the claim. I'm not making the claim. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm making the statement, but I'm giving I'm saying, here's what others have said that do have the credentials, and this is what credible scientists have said. And I think that it stands or falls on the truth of the argument, not whether it's me making it or you denying it.
I mean, what I'm getting from you, though, David, is that you probably agree on the facts of the matter. You'd be willing to grant that there's what looks like fine tuning, but it's how you interpret that.
Can I just come back on,
yeah, please,
on that?
Please.
Sure. So what you do is you defer to some guys like Brian, and you trust that they and the self-correcting nature of the discipline dots the I's and crosses the T's for our benefit. So you can use that evidence to support the idea of, you know, creation, God and the Big Bang. But then what's fascinating is in the very next chapter, you don't allow the same courtesy to that same overwhelming consensus of opinion that says evolution, macroevolution, for example, is the, you know, common descent is truth. So that is where the first real faulty line of reasoning appears, because, you know, I'm not an expert on evolutionary biology or physics, but I've got a healthy lay interest in the pop science books, so I have to defer that those guys who are studying that and the majority of the consensus have dotted the I's and crossed the T's. So I'd love to know, how is it that when it supports what you already believe to be true, you can accept the consensus, but you can't accept the consensus when it doesn't?
It's a great question, and we're going to come back to it. We're going to take a quick break. We're already through our first section here on the show. Joining me today on the programme, David Beebe, who's an atheist listener, has come in to do an interaction with Rice Brooks, who's the author of God's Not Dead. We're talking about his new book. It's an overview, really, of lots of evidences for the existence of God, for the Christian faith. So come back in a moment. We're going to continue this conversation here on Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley.
Are we the products of chance or intention? Does the cosmos leave space for God? Does Darwin dispense with God? Does the human mind reflect a mind behind the universe? Exploring the God Question is a new 6-part DVD study series investigating a major talking point of our time, science and God. Some of the world's best scientists and philosophers arguing from both sides of the debate with open, frank and rigorous discussion and fascinating results. Exploring the God Question is designed for individual or small group study, as well as for schools and public presentation. To order and find out more, visit thegodquestion.tv/explore. explore the search for truth.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon with me, Justin Brierley. Yes, it's the programme where Christians and non-Christians get together. You can find us online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. We do all kinds of discussions on theology, faith, science, ethics, philosophy, everything you can imagine, really. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Don't forget, of course, I should have mentioned this earlier, you can get in touch with the show if you've got any thoughts on what either of my guests have said today. I'd be interested to hear from you. So that's unbelievable@premier.org.uk if you want to use the email. You can also find us on Twitter @unbelievablejb if you want to get in touch that way. The Facebook page is facebook.com/unbelievablejb. And on the show today, I have Rice Brooks with me. He's the author of God's Not Dead. He's visiting from the US, and he's been touring a number of campuses talking about the evidence for God as presented in his book. If you want to find out more about some of the dates he's doing in London and further afield, godsnotdead.co.uk is the place to go. He's appearing at Imperial College. He's in Slough, Queen Mary University, Stratford, in Hammersmith too, this coming week, Tuesday the 8th through to Thursday the 10th. And also in studio with us is Brian Miller, who is a physicist who's doing some of the talking with Rice. And my atheist guest on the show today is David Beebe. He's a musician. He's a listener of the show. He's come in really just to have a dialogue, not describing himself as an expert on any level, but an interested person. Fascinated still that you listen to Christian podcasts, David. But I think that's fun. Yeah, absolutely.
It's funny.
It tests my patience through the week.
Does it?
It tests my zen.
You know? Who else do you listen to, though, just out of interest?
Well, as I say, the King's Arms Church in Bedford and Bill Johnson, the Bethel.
Oh, right. The charismatic Church. End of the spectrum as well. There you go. Right. That's a diverse range of sort of
diverse.
You know, that's interesting.
I like to hear what the other side has to say, and I like you know, early Christianity, biblical criticism, that kind of thing. I've got so another lay interest in that as well. I'm a jack of all
interests. So you just like to dip into these various aspects.
But yeah, absolutely, very much. Maybe it's a little out of my depth, maybe.
Well, if you're listening and you've got a suggestion for the podcast that David should add to his, his iPod,
send me your Christian podcast.
Be good to hear from you. We finish up that last section, David. You asked this question to Rice, and so we'll have your response now, Rice. In God's Not Dead, aren't you trying to have it both ways? He says you've got, on the one hand, you know, let's look at the consensus on fine-tuning of the universe as evidence for God. But on the other hand, you go against the grain of the majority of the biological community in questioning aspects of evolution and so on. So is that sort of a tension within the book?
First of all, I just have to thank David for reading and listening to the book, which at least he read the book and listened to it. So, and I say this respectfully, I don't really follow what he's saying about that. I mean, I think I have maybe five more footnotes in chapter four than I do chapter five. So, in terms of referencing people, I'm certainly referencing experts. I think what I say let me just start with this: when we talk about fine tuning, what my basic contention is that you have basically two explanations of the universe. Either it started itself, so there's nothing beyond nature, which is the naturalistic viewpoint, or it was started by something besides itself, a supernatural entity. And so for the universe to start itself, it has to come out of nothing. So you have men like Lawrence Krauss writing books, A Universe from Nothing. I went down to the Global Atheist Convention in April of 2012.
Is that the one in Australia?
It was in Melbourne, yes. Yeah. Listened to Lawrence Krauss, and Lawrence and Richard Dawkins, basically saying, you know, we're very insignificant. I mean, Krauss ended the speech he gave by saying, my message to you today is that your life is, I'm going to paraphrase it, but you're more insignificant than you ever imagined. And then I went up to Toronto to the debut of their new movie, The Unbelievers. So I sat and listened to that. And basically, there's this sense that somehow nothing can produce everything. And so basically, in the fine-tuning situation, or the universe coming out of nothing, it's really not nothing. That's why Lawrence Krauss can talk for a long time about nothing. There's different kinds of nothing. Mm-hmm. And so basically what you have is you have a little asterisk by nothing. And so in essence, nothing doesn't really mean nothing. It means you have to have the laws of physics there. So you have a choice. You either have an eternal set of laws that have just been there, or you have an eternal lawgiver. So that's my proposition in chapter 4, if I summed it up. Mm-hmm. Now, in chapter 5, life is no accident. I followed the line of reasoning of John Lennox and sat and had lunch with John, gave him a book, and showed him the places that I'd quoted him. But basically, Lennox said this to Dawkins in a debate. He said, you know, evolution only tells you what happens after you get life. It doesn't explain where life came from. So my central contention, even though I do chime in and talk about it, I don't think evolution is a grand story of existence. I think it has its holes, and I don't think it tells it all. I'm not just saying, well, I'm just going to accept that. I mean, I was in the home dropping another name of Francis Collins when I was doing this book, and the Human Genome Project, and he's debated Dawkins in Time Magazine, and he's a theistic evolutionist. So you're talking about brilliant minds. I mean, in trying to figure out where people are coming from, there are devout believers that accept all of what evolution says.
Absolutely.
And believe God started that.
That's kind of my point, really, because...
But my point, one last thing, and then I'll let you respond. But sure. The point of Chapter 5 really is, to me, that the origin of life, that first cell... That the miracle of that really what you end up with is just these preposterous speculations, like maybe it came from outer space, which is what some of the ones, because it's just impossible for life to have produced itself. And that's why I say life is no accident.
Sure. So in chapter 5, I just think that I'm not really expecting us to change each other's minds on the evidence for God. But what I'm really wanted to sort of just make my point hopefully clear is that the way that you're assessing it isn't evenly fair, and I don't really think that you've perhaps answered that. In chapter 5, you cite Francis Collins, John Polkinghorne. Oh, sorry, throughout the book, you cite Francis Collins, John Polkinghorne, Michael Behe. Now, all three of those guys believe in common descent, but that's not made clear in chapter 5. I don't think it's a fair presentation of the evidence, whereas where the evidence... supports, you know, with cosmology in chapter 4, it's a very, you know, it's like trumpeting it because it is supporting my pre-existing belief. But in chapter 5, it's not, I don't think it's fair to the readers, especially if they're not well read or you know, into these kind of subjects. It's using the authority or the guys that are dotting the I's and crossing the T's, but slightly, I think, not fairly.
We were talking during the break about how that we were mentioning this thing called the God test, which we use on campuses, which is really a dialogue tool. And you really want to thoroughly listen to people. We talk about you start conversations, you ask questions, listen, and then you talk and tell the story if you're a Christian. So it gets out of this shouting match. And I really appreciate David's what he's saying. So in the spirit of that, I don't want to just quickly dismiss what your point is. I may have done that. So I mean, I'm not trying to get into that, looking back. You know, I'll go back and look at that chapter and say this. But let me say what I really am trying to defend in chapter 5 is the statement that is the title: "Life is no accident." So I'm not trying. Maybe you're saying that you're using theistic evolutionists to kind of, but not bringing out the point that they do believe in evolution. But I do mention that if you read it closely, that many men like this, and I mentioned, I think Collins is a theistic evolutionist. So I think the point I'm trying to make, though, David, is to stick to the main point, is that there was a beginning. That's chapter 4. And I think we don't even have to get any further than that of how do you explain the age-old question, why is there something rather than nothing? And so if you are an atheist and you have to, the universe demands an explanation. As Einstein said, you know, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that the universe is comprehensible. So why is this universe comprehensible? Why is this mathematical order there? Why should we trust our reason? If reason is a product of just, you know, random processes, why should we trust it?
I take what you're saying. I think with the point of the, you know, the discussion for me was to just talk about the clarity of thought, the critical thinking skills in how we are assessing it. Because, for example, the arguments with reducible complexity is you cite and quote Behe. And I think he sat in this very studio.
But explain what that is. Explain to the average person, irreducible complexity means that there are systems that basically the parts, like let's say the eye, that all have to be there. there's certain things, like in order to have DNA, you have to have protein. To have to have protein, you have to have DNA. So the evolutionary picture of things can evolve and each part evolve into what we have today, that there's certain things that are irreducibly complex. In other words, you have to have all of those pieces there to, to for it to function.
But when you look at the body of work and the, as I say, going back to this consensus idea of how we base what we believe to be, how we form our own opinions of what's true when we're not smart enough to do ourselves, then it's I think it's just an unfair way of presenting the evidence.
Because in your view, that irreducible complexity is not regarded by the majority of the scientific community as
sure.
As a
I'm
sort
not
of
trying to say I can't. I don't have the ability to. I mean, I can give the twee answers about the things I've wicked and googled and read in other people that defend it. But I don't have the ability to.
David, I'm not. Evolution is really beside the point here. The point, no, the point in that chapter is it life, the origin of life. I'm not. I mean, in me going on and explaining my views on that, I felt like to leave that out of what my, you know, what I think about that would probably have been, you know, people saying, well, what do you think about this? The main point I attempted to make was is that life is no accident, that let's talk about where life came from. Remember the book Evolution from Space, Fred Hoyle and Rick Ramasing, and they assessed the probability that life could have, you know, started itself, and they came up with this crazy equation, 1 in 10 to the 40,000th. So, and they said it's the same thing as a tornado going through a junkyard, throwing the debris up into the air, and it falls to the ground, piecing together a 747 full of gas ready to fly, something like that. So, I mean, let's just put evolution aside. The complexity of life from the very beginning, to me, demands an explanation.
I have to linger on that, though, because you talk about quite strongly about the following the evidence, whatever it may lead.
Yes.
And I do find this with a lot of apologetics. It's following the evidence wherever it leads, so long as it's leading in the direction of God. And the problem that I have with that is how do you explain the vast preponderance of? So I mean, in your opinion, I genuinely would like to know. Like, so do you think like Francis Collins is wrong, and he's assessing the evidence? He's wrong on his assessment of the evidence for macroevolution.
I think that everybody comes to the table with a set of presuppositions, and you see the evidence through whatever grid you have. If you have a naturalistic grid, then you'll see it that way. Now, Collins sees. I mean, he looks at it from a genetic standpoint, so he sees similarities in genetics as evidence for, let's say, common descent. But because of the origin of life issues, would say, but it couldn't have happened
absolutely
by itself.
Yeah.
So he holds those two in tension.
Yeah.
I would say that the similarity genetically doesn't say common descent, but common designer. So I think if I look at it, so I hear what you're saying. Am I just doing this because that's what I want to believe? Let me stop and say this. I went to church growing up, but didn't like it. In the book, I mentioned that basically my own older brother was an atheist who came home from law school his third year to talk me out of the Christian faith. And he had been studying everything you can study. Now, this was a few years ago before the new atheist hit town. But that very weekend, we baptized my brother. And I remember him coming up and saying, after we baptized him, he said, you know, you haven't really answered all my questions. He said, but I think I was asking the wrong question. And I think that you can easily dismiss what any Christian says, because, well, you, of course you're believing that because you already believe in God. So let me just lay my cards on the table. Absolutely. I have a bias. Because I believe in him, and I didn't come to God like Brian here. Brian, you know, lost his faith, what little he had, and then read all of these things and then came back kind of through reason. Mine was not like that. I didn't come through this great intellectual journey and then found faith. I found faith and knew God was real enough certainty to trust in what I couldn't know. I call it certain uncertainty, not uncertain uncertainty, which is what I had. I had certain uncertainty, but that meant I knew enough that I could follow and listen to the rest of the evidence. So I've listened, just like you've listened to the Mark Driscolls and others. I've been to the Global Atheist Convention. I've read the books. And I haven't gone in there with my fingers in my ears going, oh, I can't hear this. I mean, I've literally wanted to hear everything and looking for something that would be compelling that God does not exist. And it's just, and for me to
have
be the
read,
skeptic of that.
Sorry, have you read Jerry Coyne's Why Evolution is True? Because you quote...
I have it on my Kindle.
Awesome, right? But you see, like, the,
I have it here on the phone.
There are the evidence, you know, the evidence being like there's so many things that only make sense in light of macroevolution, though. And that's there was so you talk about the fossil record, which is one line, I guess, and DNA. But just talking about going back to like the common designer versus common descent, again, Michael Behe himself talks about that being such strong evidence for common descent. It's to use the argument of common design is it really does stroke a special pleading, because if you take the gene that is for making vitamin C, and Brian, hopefully you're going to know where I'm going with this, in that it's to say that, well, it's common design that chimps and humans both have this broken gene for vitamin C is far less plausible and more like special pleading than to say, well, that's a very good strong evidence of common descent. But you don't, again, like in that chapter 5, I don't think it's, you don't present all the lines of evidence for evolution. And I just think that is something that I felt was juxtaposed against chapter 4 that just didn't feel quite fair. And I'm not trying to prove.
Why don't we bring Brian in at this point? Brian, obviously biology not your speciality, but I'm sure you've got a fair grounding in some of these issues. I mean, do you want to just chime in on this aspect of the discussion?
Yeah, and thank you so much for your questions. They've been really helpful. And and you're right. What happens is you have to realize that whenever a scientist looks at data, whenever a theologian looks at the world, whether you're an atheistic theologian or a Christian, you always come to table with a lens, with a set of assumptions. Mm-hmm. So either you can assume that everything we see is purely blind chance, or that there is a designer and a purpose behind it. So chapters 4 and 5 are completely interconnected. So if there is a designer for our universe, for the Earth, then it probably makes sense that there's a designer for life. And if there's not a designer for our universe, then obviously life is just an accident. And yes, absolutely. When we presented the material in chapter 5, which is on life, yes, there was a bias, obviously. It's our lens. And because it was a short chapter, it's impossible to write, you know, the 10,000 pages of material that were needed. And and you're right, because with cosmology, there is a general understanding and an acceptance that there is fine-tuning. Even the atheists recognize it, which is why they go to multi-universes. Now, and obviously with biology, they accept the Darwinian framework that's purely naturalistic. And this is also important to realize. In science, you have to assume a naturalistic framework as you do your research.
Methodological naturalism, sure.
Right, but that doesn't mean it's true. That just means that's the rules that scientists have to play by. So they have to push a naturalistic explanation as far as it can go. And I totally respect that. If I were a biologist, I would be working in an evolutionary framework. However, if you ask about the overarching lens, so you can look at the whole thing, the history of the church, you can look at the resurrection, you can look at cosmology, you can look at biology. If you look at it from the lens of design, I would argue it's almost like you ever put on like the wrong pair of glasses and things are really fuzzy? But then you put on the right pair of glasses and things make sense. So when you look at the totality of the evidence with a design perspective, it actually makes more sense. Now, with biology, for instance, and I've really studied this because that was a big deal, and I go and I lecture on campuses and I talk to evolutionary professors afterwards all the time. And I'll just kind of mention this. The issue of irreducible complexity or whatever details you want to get into, a design perspective makes more sense. It allows better predictions and it allows science to advance. Well, I would argue that the evolutionary perspective has held science back. In fact, what you're finding now is evolutionists are abandoning neo-Darwinism. They're going to things like Stuart Kaufman. You may have heard of Kaufman. He's going into self-organization. People like Simon Conway Morris, who's an evolutionist, is sort of saying that neo-Darwinism isn't going to work. And more evolutionists are going that direction. Now, in terms of your argument for common ancestry, that's not necessarily incompatible, because we don't believe necessarily we're not saying – we try to be a minimalist in the chapter. So what could happen is God could be the designer, but he could use natural processes at different levels, right?
I'm going to grant
– Sure.
I'm not even here to really just prove there's no God or whatever. I think, that's never going to happen. So my goal was to see that – you talk about this lens. So right. My contention here is that I think your lens is unfairly colouring the way you present chapter 5 so that it's not a fair assessment of the evidence. Now going back to the presuppositions and this lens and methodological naturalism, you're absolutely right. It can't, you know, you were saying in the book, science can't prove itself. But we have to, when we're in the lab and when we're doing science, we have to assume that natural events have natural causes. Otherwise, it could not, the endeavor of science couldn't work. But the reason that it can be validated somewhat is that it works. We have objective, we can send probes around the solar system, and we have the sort of self-correcting cumulative steps of science somewhat go some way to validating the presuppositions. I'm not saying it can philosophically prove it, but practically we are very fruitful for it.
No, you're absolutely right. That's a fantastic point. But here's my major point, is when you look at where science has succeeded, it's really succeeded in the kind of everyday mechanics of our world. And as you probably have researched, a lot of the reason that science emerged was because people believed in a lawgiver. They believed in a creator who designed the universe rationally so that we could determine those laws. Where science has failed is when it's not recognized the overarching design and that overarching pattern. So what you're saying is absolutely true, but I would argue that even in biology, let me give you a very specific example. Mm-hmm. People who believe that life was simply an accident, let's not even worry about the mechanisms, but that life is here by accident, they said, because we believe that, we think that 98% of the DNA is junk DNA. People that believed it was designed said, no, we think if it's designed, we should find more design. In the last several years, what's happened is they found like 80% of what they thought was junk DNA was actually useful. And so, again, that's important. Also, it relates to...
That's not proof for design, though, you see.
Right, but it's going in that direction, that the design is fitting the evidence better. But let me just make one more point. What you said before is great, because you're asking the question, why is it that if God is real, he doesn't make it really, really obvious? And the point that the book is making is that what God has done is he's put clues and evidence around us, but it's not coercive. So there's enough evidence, enough details out there. So if people want to find him, they can, but it's not so much that it's coercive. That's kind of the point.
That's a really interesting point. I mean, it would be good. We spent quite a lot of time on the issue of the biology and the physics and so on. And I totally understand that you're probably still got big questions over those chapters and whatever, David.
Yeah,
but coming back to this fundamental question, which you started out with, which I think Brian has nicely sort of encapsulated there, of, well, if there is a God, surely that God would want to make it very obvious that they're there if my eternal fate is hanging in the balance. And so Brian says, well, God at the same time doesn't want to be coercive. What do you make of that sort of a view? Because you obviously feel like, well, if there is evidence, it should be more blindingly obvious than it is.
Coming more along to, I guess, my objections to Christianity. If the fate of my eternal soul is so important, then I would want to be, I wouldn't want the choice. I'm not really sure that I completely believe in free will, but why give me the choice to risk it? If you're going to set the system up, if some more powerful creator is going to set the system up from the very beginning and has these rules and laws, then why give me the option to potentially make the wrong choice? If it's I'm going to be alive hopefully for 70, 80 years, I'm going to be dead for a lot longer than that. So if it's so crucially important after
but
I die,
but David, then... surely you you're a musician. You kind of look like one of the Beatles. His hair, and he's a musician. So that's, of course, that's my lens as an American coming and hearing an Englishman who's a musician.
Well, you look very American as well, right? So I must say.
Good. I am from there, so I guess that makes sense. Yeah. I think you really do want that choice. I mean, you want the choices. You want the risk of living, and that's kind of the miracle of this opportunity, that he could have created us. Kind of like in the movie Liar, Liar, when Jim Carrey wants to tell a lie but can't, and he's, his mouth is muzzled. Or, we could be like little kids on one of those when I take my kids to an amusement park and they think they're driving the car, but it's on a track, and they're doing all this motion, but it's really something that's just programmed for them. But I think he's made himself clear enough in creation. And then I'll go out on a limb and say I think that God actually submitted himself to the ultimate science experiment. That this invisible, uncreated, spaceless, timeless God became a man in Jesus Christ 2,000 years ago. And so when God becomes a man, in Christ, and he walks among us, and he's handled, he's tested. I mean, if you want to talk about, I mean, you, in the average scientist may not like my analogy, but think about it. He's doing things in history. He's speaking, he's acting, he's healing, and yet, so God, in essence, does that. He submits himself to that experiment, if you will, and then his resurrection from the dead, I believe, in history, is something that we can say, well, if you're going to put my eternal soul out there and make it somehow in question, I think he comes down in history and reveals himself, not just through rocks, not just through fine-tuning, not just through cells, but through his life, death, and resurrection.
We're going to have to take another quick break, and we're going to already be at the end of the program. It's flown by today, as you can tell. You were talking today about evidence, atheism, the case for God, particularly in regards to a new book, God's Not Dead, by Rice Brooks. He's one of my guests in the studio today, co-founder of the Every Nation family of churches. If you want to find out more about the book, godsnotdead.org will take you there, or if you want to find out about some of the events he's speaking at in the coming week in London and elsewhere, godsnotdead.co.uk. My atheist guest is David Beebe, who's a show listener. Going to be finishing off this conversation in a moment's time here on the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable. Welcome back to Unbelievable. It's Saturday afternoon. I'm Justin Brierley, your host, through till about 4 o'clock today. At 4 o'clock, I'll be handing over to our political editor, Martin Eden, who's in conversation today on The Profile with Jim Wallis, who's well known in the US as a political campaigner. He's a Christian. He's written a book recently on political involvement. And so they're going to be talking about that, about Jim's life and faith. So do check that out between 4 and 5 this afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. And a bit later on, Dave Rose is here looking back at some of the past week's programming, bringing you some of the best bits and so on. Do, of course, go to the Unbelievable website to find out more about my guests who have joined me on the program today. That's at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And of course, you can get in touch as well if you want to comment on today's show. And I'm going to give out again the ways to do that when we come to some of your feedback in about 10 minutes time or so. Next week on the show, if you come back, we're doing something quite different. We're doing a theological discussion between a Protestant and a Catholic. Yes, we're going to have on someone who always raises opinions whenever he comes on this show, James White from the States. He's a Reformed theologian, Bible scholar, and he's done a number of debates with Catholics. He'll be in conversation with Peter D. Williams, who's from Catholic Voices, and the question they're going to be debating is, what is the ultimate authority for Christians? Is it Scripture alone, which is the view that James White will be taking, or is it Scripture plus? Because Peter D. Williams believes it's also about church teaching and church tradition, that these are, if you like, three things that are the ultimate authority for Christians when it comes to what they understand of their faith. So that should be a really interesting discussion. Same time next week between Peter D. Williams and James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So wrapping up today's programme, we've been having a fascinating discussion between Rice Brooks, who's the author of God's Not Dead. You can find it at godsnotdead.org and find out about his speaking events here in the UK in the coming week at godsnotdead.co.uk. Our other guest has been David Beebe, who's a show listener. Very grateful, David, that you volunteered. Well, I've sort of volunteered you, actually.
Thank you for inviting me. I mean, I feel, you know, say honoured and humbled, really. So it's nice to get the chance to. Normally, I'm just sort of shouting into my iPhone, like, and I'm listening. And
lots of people talk about shouting when they listen to the show, both Christians and atheists, but actually. It's great to have you. I mean, and I do appreciate you sort of, you know, being willing to put yourself out there and come on and just sort of have an open discussion.
It's been fascinating.
It's been great. Just in that last section of the program, David, Rice kind of painting this bigger picture of, you know, God kind of did a scientific experiment. He came to Earth, and that obviously is the core of the Christian view of God, that he is expressed in Jesus Christ and so on. I mean, again, for you, presumably evidence is important at this point in terms of what we can know about this character and so on.
Yeah, I think we're going to rapidly run out of time to get into this, but I just find it interesting that I don't want to obviously speak for you, but I presume you think the evidence for the historical resurrection of Jesus is very strong.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So again, what I would propose to you is that the lens that you already believe that makes you see that evidence as strong. And what I think you've difficult to explain from that position is if that evidence is so strong, and I know I'm sorry to keep coming back to it, why is perhaps the evidence for common descent or macroevolution, why is that not convincing? And it just puts into... paints a wider picture of the assessment of evidence of how you, sure. of how you're reasoning, how you're critically evaluating the evidence. So that would be, I mean, I think that if you're prepared to accept on 2,000 year old documents and textual transmission and criticism, etc., that the Holy Spirit wrote this book through men, then there was a physical resurrection, something that completely defies all of our known experience and knowledge for the last 2,000 years of the physical real world. If you think the evidence for that is so strong, then there's a breakdown, I think, honestly, in your line of reasoning. If something like that potentially goes against your worldview, say macroevolution, you don't find that convincing. So I guess that's what I wanted sure. to articulate today.
Well, kind of back to your thought about your own eternal soul. My yeah. soul and my destiny doesn't really depend on my view of evolution. So maybe I can prioritize sure. things of what I think. If somehow I thought that, maybe I've not that I haven't studied it or examined it, but I think that the resurrection is not only is it compelling. I mean, I lived in Jerusalem for a while, and you could hardly meet anybody there that doubted Jesus lived.
It's a fascinating place.
When you go and you can go and say, well, he died here, and then he was, but the
and that's
the
up for debate.
The conclusion, yeah, I know. There's two tombs. Yeah, yeah. I mean, two.
And this would be my point.
But there's no doubt that Christianity started in the very place where it would have been easiest to disprove. It started in Jerusalem, and these disciples went out from that place. And you study early Christianity, you see this, I call it the third Big Bang. You had the Big Bang at the beginning of the universe. You had what Brian was actually trying to refer to in the fossil record, which we could get into, the Cambrian explosion, where life begins.
We're not going to get into that.
I know,
I'm getting to my third Big Bang. And then the Big Bang
we'll
is
leave
the
that
emergence,
to when I do a program with Stephen Meyer.
20 million years
the
is
emergence
not really an
of the church, the emergence of the church and the proclamation of the gospel. So I do believe that the evidence is compelling that Jesus Christ was a man of history. You said Bart Ehrman's sat in the seat. Bart, wrote the book, Did Jesus Exist? And, I mean, he's basically done a lot of disservice to many atheist causes because he said Jesus was a real person. Mm-hmm. And so
obviously
I think
he doesn't believe he came back to life.
No, I understood, but at least we can establish the fact that this is not a mythological character.
Mm-hmm. I think Bart ticks off some people on that regard, and not necessarily himself. I'm actually a big fan of his writing, but it's one of the things where he puts a bit too much weight on something that definitely. I mean, all of history is probability. So when Bart Ehrman says like Jesus definitely existed, he means within the boundaries of what we can prove with a historical method. Whereas I think then some believers will take that to mean it's actually categorically beyond any doubt at all.
But if we don't accept the evidence of biblical history we could get into Dan Wallace, the head of the New Testament Manuscript Center, and he's been a contributor to the book. I mean, the weight of evidence for the reliability of the New Testament documents, it's just you can take the average classical writer and their writing stack up about 4 feet high. The New Testament's a mile high. So if we doubt history, then we got to throw out all of ancient history. So at some point we have to...
I mean, we're talking here about reasonable doubt, aren't we? We'll never know anything with 100% certainty.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's about what we can assign something as having sort of...
And when you look at the pelvis in some species of whales and the leg bones that are just sitting there in the flesh, how do you explain that in terms of not being beyond reasonable doubt as to where whales came from off the land?
But the proposal, we want to get into the cow weighed into the water. I mean,
it's if historical documents are so compelling and are really, really a strong definitive point of evidence, then how we look at the evidence for other things that do test our pre-held beliefs, I think is really important and just something to bear in mind when second edition, maybe.
May I say one last thing? First of all, I thank you, David, for coming on, and I appreciate you. You are studying. You're not just a – many atheists are just kind of these drive-by insults.
No, you're not like that.
You are really thoughtful, and you have some great questions, and I'd like to take you to lunch afterwards, and you can tell me what else is wrong with my book. As long as somebody out there buys it, then they can say, I bought it twice now. Thank you so much.
There you go. It's been great. Thank you. I think you've asked some excellent questions, David. Thank you for coming in as well, and Brian as well for joining you.
Thank you, Brian.
Rice. It's been really good. And again, if you want to find out a bit more yourself, godsnotdead.co.uk, a good place to go to find out more. We're out of time, so thank you again, gentlemen, for being with me in the studio today. Have a good lunch together, and I'm sure we'll see you again in some guise
thank
at some
so
point
much,
down,
Justin.
Down the road.
Thank you. Thank you, Justin.
It's been
really
great to have you on the show today. Of course, check out the links to both of my guests at the Unbelievable webpage. You can find that at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. We're going to get to some of your feedback in the last few weeks, and we'll find out what you've made of recent shows involving Lawrence Krauss, who's come up in today's show, John Lennox, who's also been mentioned, and Bill Craig and others who have joined me recently on the programme. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, as ever, if you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Going to be reading out a number of your messages from that direction in a moment's time. But you can also find us online. You can visit the Facebook page, facebook.com/unbelievablejb. You can go to the Twitter account, @unbelievablejb, to follow me there on Twitter. And we've got a few Facebook messages that we'll read out as well. All of those links and more, past programmes and all the rest available from the website, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can get today's programme there, of course. Let's go to some of your messages in a moment's time. Firstly, though, a quick thank you. If you were someone who contributed to last week's Syria appeal, it was for Open Doors in aid of getting Bibles into the hands of persecuted Christians in Syria. I mentioned it on last week's show, and we have had a fantastic response across the whole week that we were running that campaign last week. Over £60,000 donated towards that. That is thousands and thousands of Bibles into the hands of persecuted Christians in Syria. So if you were involved in that, helping to provide Bibles, a big, big thank you. Such an important thing. Let's go to some of your emails now. Kirsty says, I was listening to the programme of last week or the week before that was discussed quite a bit, the heated discussion when a man kept pressing a buzzer. Where is it, please? I can only assume you're referring to the debate that took place in Australia, or one of three debates, between atheist physicist Lawrence Krauss and William Lane Craig, a Christian philosopher. And yes, they came on my show a few weeks ago now to discuss those debates, and the issue of the buzzer that Lawrence Krauss, the atheist, brought along was also under discussion. I wasn't able to broadcast that whole programme. We just heard snippets from it, if you remember. But you can certainly go and find out more by typing in Lawrence Krauss, William Lane Craig, Australia debate into a search engine. Should take you there. City Bible Forum is the website where you can find all of those debates that were hosted. So I hope that helps you, Kirsty. Also, Sue Biggs says, who was the Christian on Unbelievable talking to an atheist about the beginning of creation? He's a mathematician. It was Saturday, the 21st of September. He was brilliant. You're referring to John Lennox, I believe, Sue, who joined me a couple of weeks ago, again in conversation with Lawrence Krauss, the atheist physicist. I'm imagining you were listening via the radio, your radio set, and didn't catch all the details when you tuned in. So yes, check that out online. You can go back and listen to the whole thing, of course. Available now at the website premier.org.uk/unbelievable. If you go there, scroll down to the bottom of the page and you'll see the list of past programmes, and you can scroll back well, years and years through that, or indeed go to the podcast page and subscribe that way. So hope that helps. Sue, glad you were interested in that program with John Lennox. And loads of other emails have come in about, continuing to come in about the John Lennox and Lawrence Krauss debate of a couple of weeks ago. It was the first in two programs looking specifically at a new set of DVDs called The God Question, which examine areas of science and belief like the cosmos, mind and consciousness, evolution. Well, we did two shows. Firstly, on the cosmos, Lawrence Krauss and John Lennox joined me for that. And last week was again a discussion between an atheist and a Christian. On this occasion, it was Keith Ward versus Michael Ruse on mind, consciousness and the God question. Well, we're going to see some of your responses to that one as well. Just a reminder, though, if you are interested in looking into the DVDs, purchasing them, you can find them at thegodquestion.tv, thegodquestion.tv. And if you listen to those programs, you will have heard some snippets from those DVDs. Going back to Lawrence Krauss and William Lane Craig, here's Andrew Jakovach, who says, for some reason, I felt inspired to tell you that I sincerely appreciate the work you do on Unbelievable. I listen to your show religiously, if you'll pardon the pun, every week, all the way from Australia. As I'm sure you're aware, the programme format is quite short and limiting, but its content is always top class. Loads of side info to do further searching to supplement your dialogues. As evidenced by Krauss and Craig's dialogues here in Australia, us Aussies are in desperate need of higher profile and genuine public dialogue. Geez, I'm glad I was late in booking tickets for the Brisbane debate. I didn't waste my money on it. More importantly, I had a bunch of searcher friends I was going to buy tickets for, and I'm glad I didn't drag them to a debate that may have turned them off the topic. Krauss's fault completely. Not sure I have a solution for it, this Australian need for deeper public apologetic dialogue, but I am being emotionally pulled from somewhere deep within to somehow do something about that problem in our extremely secular Australian society. I'll keep thinking, but if you have any ideas, I'd be more than happy to hear them. Well, all the very best for you, Andrew, as you look to try and do something creative in the area of public dialogue on apologetics in Australia. And, well, I'm sure there are many others who feel the same way. Here's Phil, who says, I really enjoyed the debate you hosted with Lawrence Krauss and John Lennox. Very interesting and well done. Far better than the rather chaotic debates in Australia. Lawrence Krauss was kind enough to mention our videos in his debate on the issue of animal suffering. And you can find that at skepticinc.com. But you say, that's not the reason I write. I think something you said on the show wasn't scientifically accurate. This was the comment that the latest theories in cosmology point to a beginning of the universe. Well, I've made a comment on your Facebook page about it and provided a link that I think clears up the misconception about what the phrase Big Bang really means. And you've linked me there to einstein-online.info/spotlights/big_bangs. And what the latest theories actually say. Obviously, that's a point of contention that came up between Lawrence Krauss and William Lane Craig in their debates. Also, of course, was mentioned at least briefly in the John Lennox and Lawrence Krauss debate on this programme. I think most people would agree that Big Bang cosmology does speak of time, space, matter, all beginning in some sense of the word at cosmological singularity, whether you talk about a sort of beginning from nothing or it kind of going back to an infinitely dense point or whatever needs further explanation. But thank you very much. Surgeon also wanted to get in touch, says Krauss is very much correct on the why question. It is really begging the question or the fallacy of assuming one's conclusion in the question itself. We can ask the why question of a Ford car because there are conscious agents involved along the way, but we don't know if there are any conscious agents behind the universe. So the why question might, and I would say probably does, have no answer at all. So that's the point of view of a surgeon when it comes to their dialogue on the cosmos and whether there's space for God. And here's Carl in Norfolk who says, the Lennox versus Krauss show, near the end you brought up the point that some feel the simple theist God invoked in these discussions about the universe seems ad hoc, a being endowed with overarching properties that make it sufficient to explain everything. Bonhoeffer took this concern seriously in his writings about religionless Christianity and even said that apologists who invoke God in this way are using him as a deus ex machina. It was a shame then that Lennox dismissed the concern with a flippant remark about it akin to saying, saying Henry Ford doesn't explain anything about cars. To reverse an argument Lennox made near the start of the show, if great minds have taken the objection seriously, why can't we? Lennox went on to say that anyway, he's arguing for the God of Christianity, not the God of the gaps that Krauss dismisses. However, when Krauss challenged Lennox on this, Lennox explained that he believes in the God of the Bible because of special revelation, and he added, but that is another issue. The thing is, if Lennox needs special revelation to get to specifically the Christian God, then he's acknowledging, after all, that his fine-tuning and cosmological arguments only arrive at the mostly content-free God of theism, in which case it's fair to ask whether positing God in this way is any different to saying something like an explanation that is sufficient to explain. But all credit to John for dealing with Krauss's rude interruptions, but Lennox ought to try to remember that some of the questions debate adversaries fire at him are the same questions that seekers and Christians themselves struggle with. Keep up the excellent broadcasting. Thank you, Carl. I mean, my comments on that would be that I think John would acknowledge that, yes, the arguments from fine-tuning and cosmological arguments are simply part of a cumulative case if you're talking about the God of Christianity, which don't obviously show all the attributes of that God, and that, yes, certain aspects of that God would be by special revelation from the Bible in the person of Jesus, obviously, in the case of Christianity. Though, does that mean that we can't point to some of the more general aspects of design, purpose, creative power, and so on through other arguments than that? Interesting. Okay, Josh says, moving on to last week's discussion, which was Michael Ruse and Keith Ward in debate over mind and consciousness and whether they provide evidence for God. He says, I must say this week was a wonderful breath of fresh air after enduring a couple of weeks of Mr. Krauss's non sequitur, uninformed mudslinging that he calls discussion. Michael Ruse was a joy to listen to as he was respectful and sincere, much like John Lennox. In fact, I'd love to hear a discussion between the two of them, not that this week's guest wasn't up to snuff. Now, I need to go back and listen again as there was actually some content covered beyond the bumper stickers, down to which Krauss insisted on reducing these issues. David Robertson emails in, of course, no stranger to Unbelievable himself. He says, I found the Krauss-Lennox discussion as frustrating as I expect John Lennox did. Krauss is the Westboro Baptist of the new atheism. He was crass, rude and arrogant and astonishingly illogical. To declare to just forget reason and observe empirical evidence, to announce that philosophy is useless, was breathtaking. To then redefine words like nothing, so that they just simply mean whatever he wants them to mean, is more Alice in Wonderland than it is science. One could almost forgive the rudeness if he had said something substantive, but his rejection of logic and reason was demonstrated in many ways, none more so than when he tried to compare faith in the Bible with faith in The Great Gatsby. It may have escaped his notice, but The Great Gatsby is a novel. You can argue about the truth of the Bible, but it was not written as fiction. John Lennox was superb as always, and of course the upside of Krauss's performance is that I can simply direct my atheist friends to listen to it, and it'll make them want to convert. On the other hand, last week's programme with Ruse and Ward was superb, the best Unbelievable this year. Genial, intelligent, stimulating and great fun. It was a relief after the previous week. And others continue in that vein. A lot of appreciation for last week's debate between Michael Ruse and Keith Ward. Pastor Daniel Sinclair in California says, what a relief to hear the conviviality of Michael Ruse. After the acerbic and somewhat infantile responses of Krauss, I enjoy the fact that Ruse wouldn't let your Christian guest go from possibility to probability to surety without an argument. And I love the sense that both speakers were trying to argue from first principles rather than getting entangled in downstream secondary issues. And on the Facebook page, a number of people wanted to comment on that program as well. Again, if you want to comment yourself on Facebook, like the page, follow what I put up there from week to week. It's facebook.com/unbelievablejb. Michael Goff is an atheist. He says, if consciousness was separate from the brain itself, then there are 7 billion people alive right now filling the universe with their thoughts. Now, add up the ones that have already lived and died, then add up the ones that haven't lived yet. A cacophony and complete garbage. You aren't even you from moment to moment. Your experiences make you who you are. Your mind is an emergent property of who you think you are this moment. So Michael Goff very much taking the reductionist approach to the aspect of mind. We are simply a product of the chemical and physical processes going on in our brain. There is no actual self there. Interesting, because Steve Cooper comments along those lines on the Facebook page and says, metaphysical naturalists, as Alex Rosenberg for one, have to claim, as nothing exists but matter, energy and forces, that mind is just an illusion and there are no intentional states of consciousness. And it isn't just Christian neurologists who don't buy that. David Kirkland says, I applaud Michael Ruse for conducting himself very well, being professional, showing common decency and respect. He also seems to confront and discuss points and arguments realistically and not just dismiss them or resort to insults. I'd recommend people listen to the recent Please Convince Me podcast by Jay Warner Wallace, titled Are We More Than Simply Physical Beings? I thought it was excellent and I learned a lot about the subject. And finally on Facebook, Matt Crump said, this was a great podcast, referring again here to Michael Ruse and Keith Ward in debate last week. And although I don't share his position, I was very impressed by the charm of Michael Ruse in this dialogue. He was surprisingly respectful and interesting to listen to. Keith Ward spoke well too. Kudos to both gentlemen for not speaking over each other's heads. Well moderated too. Thank you very much for being in touch. Thanks to all those who have been in touch as well this past week in regard to recent programmes. Great to get your feedback, and do send it in again if you'd like to get in touch about today's program. You can of course phone and leave a message that way, 08456 52 52 52. Leave a voicemail message for Unbelievable and I'll try and play that out. You can of course email as well, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. What an interesting show it's been today. Hope you can come back same time, same place next week.
You're unbelievable.
I'm going to be joined on the show by Peter D. Williams and James White. We're going to be discussing Catholicism and Protestantism, particularly what should the ultimate authority be for Christians. Well, as a Catholic, Peter D. Williams will be arguing that it's Scripture plus church teaching and church tradition in the Catholic tradition. On the other hand, James White, who's well known online and for his podcast and radio show as a Reformed apologist, he'll be arguing for sola scriptura, that Scripture alone is the authority for Christians. So it's going to be a fantastic, highly educated debate at the same time next week. Hope you can come back for that here on the show that aims to get you thinking. Unbelievable, every Saturday between 2:30 and 4 o'clock. I've been Justin Brierley. Coming up next, though, you're going to be hearing the Profile interview. And today, Premier's political editor Martin Eden is in conversation with political campaigner and Christian Jim Wallace. So do stay tuned for that if you're here on Premier Christian Radio between 4 and 5. Otherwise, I'll see you next week here on Unbelievable.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint or stain project, saving is at the top of your to-do list. Save now with buy one, get one half off select paints, stains, and primers from top brands like Valspar, HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams, and Cabot via Visa gift card rebate. Find more Memorial Day deals now at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 5/15 through 5/28.
O'Reilly Auto Parts puede ayudarte a revisar tu Luz Check Engine, Luz ABS o Luz de Mantenimiento con O'Reilly Veriscan. El servicio es gratis y recibirás un informe con soluciones verificadas por técnicos maestros certificados ASE. Si necesitas ayuda, O'Reilly Auto Parts te puede recomendar un taller. Pregunta por O'Reilly Veriscan hoy mismo.
O'Reilly.